Welcome to Hit the Bottle Podcast, a show for beverage sales and marketing professionals looking to up their game and further their careers and businesses. Viewed through the lens of strategy, technology, and leadership, we explore everything from digital marketing, e-commerce, brand building, public relations, and much more. Each week, we chat with industry experts and leaders, explore practical applications, and discuss what's happening in our world. Our goal is to provide you with the insights and strategies you need to create successful marketing programs. Now it's time to hit the bottle.
Hey, HTB podcast listeners, it's Mike Wambickler again, and today we're joined on the podcast by an old friend, somebody I've known for almost 20 years, Jeff Siegel, otherwise known as the Wine Curmudgeon, writer, author of the Wine Curmudgeon's Guide to Cheap Wine, an excellent freelance writer and an all-around mensch. This is Jeff Siegel. Thanks for being on the show, man.
Thank you, Mike. It's a real pleasure. I've been looking forward to doing this for a very long time.
Well, we did record an episode for your podcast as well, and we commented that it's been a long time. We should have done this a long time ago. So I'm glad that we're finally getting around to it. So today I wanted to approach a subject that is near and dear to our hearts, and that is basically kind of this whole change in the media landscape that's happened over the last, 20 years or so. And with the COVID pandemic has kind of accelerated some of that. So I just thought we'd kind of wax nostalgic a little bit about like how it was in the good old days and then talk about how things are today. So Jeff, remind me and my listeners, when you started writing about wine and what started all that.
So I've been doing the blog, the Wine Curmudgeon, winecurmudgeon.com now, subscription via Substack since the fall, November of 2007. Before that, I've been writing about wine freelance. I was a wine columnist for the Star-Telegram newspaper in Fort Worth. So I've now been doing this probably close to 30 years, which means that I've seen the old days. I saw the days that replaced the old days, and I've seen the postmodern days, and it's been, God, it really has been a long, strange trip.
And you started in sports writing.
Oh, a long time ago. In fact, I was talking to an old friend of mine about this the other day. I covered high school sports in the suburbs of Chicago when I got out of college in the late 1970s, early 1980s. That was high school basketball, Crystal Lake, Illinois, in a Chicago pre-climate change Chicago February. That was a lot of fun.
Well, it's interesting to see, we probably know several people who had a background in sports writing who also kind of took up the wine beat back in the 80s, 90s. Because I think that there was this increased demand for content regarding wine during that time, because in the wine sector, especially the American wine sector, was seeing some new attention.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons so many sports writers got into it is, first off, we traveled. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to somebody who covers the cops or city government, where you go to the police station or you go to the city hall and that's where you spend all your time, if you're a sports writer, you're on the road a lot. And so you taste different stuff. And so you get a chance to do different stuff, to have wine with dinner and so on and so forth. And the other thing about it is, and I this is going to sound silly, but sports writers typically were some of the best writers on a newspaper, because you were allowed a little more leeway. You didn't have to say, the city council voted 6-3 tonight to increase taxes 10%, which is basically how every city council meeting story starts. If you're covering a baseball game or a basketball game or a football game, each game is different, and you have to approach it differently. And I think that writing flair carried over, because you're right. I mean, we sat here, we could probably name 10 or 12 people who started out in wine, and many of whom are well-known and important people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think, to your point, and that is that sports writing, like wine writing, you have a certain amount of editorializing you can do, right? Yeah. You can talk about how terrible a particular batter was at the plate, or, you know, how great, you know, the home run, the grand slam home run was. Funny that we just default to baseball. But same thing with wine, because I mean, you know, when you're writing about wine as a wine writer, you're expected to offer your opinion about the wine itself and what you think of it, and, you know, perhaps give it a rating. So there's a certain similarity to that.
No, that's exactly right. Again, if you're covering the police beat, there's not a whole lot of editorial license you can put in a crime. It happens. There it is. The bank was robbed. Somebody was shot. If you're covering the city council meeting, there's not a whole lot of editorial license. But if you're on the road with default to a baseball team, if you're on the road with a baseball team, you know, 15 games in 17 days, and every game is completely different. If you don't put a little editorial license in, you'll go crazy.
Right, exactly. So, okay, so fast forward a little bit to the, I don't know, probably 20 years ago, about the time when we started to see the emergence of more electronic media, and we started to see this kind of transition, print media to electronic media, in the way that people consumed news. And how did that affect you personally, and like, what did you observe about how wine writing changed at that time?
I think one of the things that is, I love that question, by the way, because it gives me a chance to sound really intelligent. But one of the things that happened that nobody has really noticed is that during the 80s and the 90s, up until the dot-com boom at the beginning of the 21st century, which is probably the end of the heyday of print, if you wanted to sell wine in a particular town, you got a review in the local newspaper. So these people had tremendous, tremendous clout. So whether it was, now I'm going to have to try to remember names, which I won't remember, so please forgive me, everybody whose name I'm not going to do. But whether you were in Dallas or Houston or San Francisco or Philadelphia or South Florida, it was a personal relationship, and the wine marketing people, the PR people, they would know every newspaper reporter, and they would be able to pick up the phone and say, hey, listen, I got this great wine for you. I'm going to send you a sample. And I can remember, again, not with anybody's name, but at the Houston Chronicle, and Houston is a tremendous wine market, when the wine writer took retirement, they weren't going to replace him. And our friend Carmen Castorina, who was working for Gallo at the time, called the editor of the newspaper and said, this is the Houston Chronicle. This is one of the most important wine markets in America. You have to have a wine writer. And they went and found a wine writer. It was a guy who wrote sports, but also knew about wine.
Right. Yeah.
Dale.
Yep.
Okay. You can't remember Dale's last name either. Put it in the notes, Michael. Put it in the notes. But that's the kind of authority and clout and respect that newspaper wine writers had then. I did a little newspaper wine writing at the Star-Telegram newspaper in Fort Worth. And I mean, everybody returned my phone calls. So fast forward then to the beginning of the electronic age, and all of a sudden it didn't matter if you worked for a newspaper or not. And you were just one of many. And at the beginning of the internet age, everybody decided they were going to be a wine writer because they saw Robert Parker and they saw Jancis Robinson and the two or three others who were successful. And they said, oh, well, all I have to do is have a wine blog and I will be a star, which of course didn't happen. So instead of, I hate to use the term gatekeepers, but instead of respected people who knew what they were doing and knew what they were talking about. And so if you read the guy who just died in South Florida, Fred, you knew if you read his stuff, he was going to recommend a wine, and you could go to a local store and it would be available and you would enjoy it.
Yeah, Fred Tesker used to write the column for the Miami Herald, yeah.
Yeah. Instead, then we had a democratization of this, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But because it's the wine business and availability is always important, you had people writing about wine and recommending wine that no one could possibly buy. You had people recommending wine that they didn't know wasn't available. You had people recommending wine because they liked it and didn't know that it was already, our favorite thing probably about that is Beaujolais, right? Every time there's a new generation of wine people, Beaujolais becomes popular again. and you had all that stuff going. And again, it's neither good nor bad. It's just the way it changed. And it made, for those of us, for lack of a better term, who were professionals, it made our job that much more difficult.
Because I mean, basically,
what you were doing.
Yeah, with the democratization, basically what it did is it took away the necessity for the expertise, right? The expert who's no longer respected in the same way.
Because anybody could, and anybody can write about wine. And in a way, this is partly the wine media's fault, because not necessarily the newspaper.
Oh, I think it's almost entirely the wine media's fault.
Not necessarily the newspaper people, but a lot of them played into that.
Yeah.
But you had these people who set themselves up on high and said, this wine is 94 points, and you'd better damn well go out and buy it. And it didn't matter if it cost $80 or if it cost $30. I love to tell this story. A good friend of mine, a wine drinker for years and years and years, said he kept buying Robert Parker 90-point Australian Shirazes. And he came to me and he said, this is 90 points. How come I don't like it? And I said, because that's Robert Parker's opinion. You like Bordeaux. You like red Bordeaux. You like French wine. Why the hell would you buy a wine that's 90 points when it's high in alcohol, way too much fruit, et cetera, and so forth? And finally, I talked some sense into it.
Well, I think that, yes, to a certain extent, the Robert Parkers, the wine spectators, the wine enthusiasts of the world, they really kind of simplified wine criticism, down to, scores. It's a very American thing to do, and it's understandable considering, the fact that, people's time is valuable, and not everybody wants to sit there and read about, read a thousand, word article about, some obscure region in, Burgundy. They just want to know which wine actually they should buy because somebody who knows something about that wine says it's good, right? And so that's where that kind of endorsement comes in. And again, where the wine media is struggling right now, and that basically their expertise is not as valued as it once was, with exceptions. I mean, there's some people who still, they still earn the respect that they deserve, but it's become very hard for really talented freelance writers to make a living, especially just if they specialize in wine and spirits.
I've been lucky in all the years I've been doing this. I did other things besides wine because I could never make a living just by writing about wine. Mm-hmm. So, I've done trade magazines, I've done consumer magazines, I've written about other stuff, but it's always been brutal, and it's even more brutal now. And again, the thing that always struck me about wine criticism is that so much of it took so much of the fun out of wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wine is supposed to be fun. You're supposed to drink it. When I read a review, when I try to write a review, I want to tell the people why I'm excited about drinking this wine.
Right.
And you see so little of that.
Well, it's one of my, people who know me know that I get up on the soapbox once in a while. So, and the soapbox that is my favorite is the one about making sure that you are telling a unique story. Because the fact is that when you say that you are family owned, that you make your wine in the vineyard, that you're small batch, that, everything's handcrafted, blah, 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 blah. Everybody else is telling the same story, right? And everybody else can say the same thing, right? So, why should any critic care about your wine if it has no difference, if it doesn't differentiate itself from any of the other wines out there? And the fact is that, when you're starting to see a lot more where those wineries that are written about have an interesting story behind them. And it's something that interests the writer and in turn interests their readers. So, my advice to my readership is always, find whatever that uniqueness is. And if you don't know what that is and can't find it, call me. I'll help you.
That's what you've been doing successfully for a very long time.
Yeah, well, we tried.
Here's a message from our sponsor.
So, okay, so that's where we've been. Where are we now? And where do we think this is going to be going in terms of, this, I'm on the producer and the agency side. So, I'm the PR side, and then you're on the on the other side of the writing side, you know, like where's the relationships going to go between these two kind of camps, and what does the future look like if we can kind of look into the crystal ball?
I think there's a couple of things that are happening, and we can see them right now, and they revolve around the consolidation in the wine business. And that's not just on the producer side, but it's also on the retail side, and it's also on, to a lesser extent, on the wholesaler side. So let's just say in the newspaper days, you had an audience that wanted to get some advice on buying wine. So they would read the newspaper critic, and then they would go to the store with the article in hand and go buy the wine. And to a certain extent, that still happens. I know my mom does that with my stuff. But as we get fewer and fewer and bigger wineries, and we get fewer and fewer and bigger retailers, and you go to the supermarket and you got the supermarket wall of wine, which is basically four producers controlling that entire wall. And as we get more people, and I think the last number is 50-55% of the wine sold in the US is sold in supermarkets, the critic, the wine writer becomes that much less of a necessity, because the producers and the retailers control the selling space. And when I go to the supermarket, I'm going to buy what's there. And basically all the wines taste the same. They have the same cute stuff on the back label. And I'm exaggerating and oversimplifying, obviously, but they have the same cute sayings on the back label. And they're aimed at people who buy wine in the supermarket.
Yep.
And so for people like me who actually want to recommend wines that are generally widely available in the supermarket, that's a real problem. So thank God for La Ville Ferme. It's still a damn fine wine, yeah, and it's still widely available in the supermarket. So now, so on the other end, for the people that you work with on the higher end side, the critic is going to become perhaps in a different place, because you're going to need to, if I'm going to pay 80 bucks, 60, 80, 40, 60, 80 bucks for a bottle of wine, I may want more than what's on Yelp or Vivino. So I may still have to go to somebody who's going to give it 92 points. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about this is retailers are now trusted in a way they've never been before.
Mm-hmm.
People will go into Trader Joe's and will buy the absolute crappiest wine because it's a Trader Joe's and they trust Trader Joe's. And that's just not Trader Joe's. That's true at Total Wine,
BevMo, yeah.
BevMo. Well, I won't say, go
Specs.
I don't want to get you in trouble with any retailer.
Yeah, no, we're good. So has that gap widened? You know, because I think that, you know, there's always been this kind of, you know, you've got the supermarket brands and you've got like kind of everyone else, you know, and has that gap widened over the past several years?
Oh, I think it's widened tremendously. And again, this is a function of doing this for so long. I can remember when supermarkets barely sold any wine at all.
Well, and it depends on which state you were into.
Well, ignoring California.
Yeah.
But for instance, there's a fine importer in suburban Chicago called Wine Cellars. They do really nice, inexpensive wine, Argentine, French, Germans, and Spanish. And the guy who founded Wine Cellars was in the late 60s, I believe is right. He was the guy who invented the wine program for one of the Chicago area's biggest supermarket chains. Mm-hmm. This was only the late 60s, right? Yep. So by the height of the wine boom in the early 80s, right, early mid 80s, supermarkets still hadn't figured this out. They've figured it out now. Mm-hmm. And I've got friends who hate to go to wine shops, who hate to go to independent liquor stores because it's just too much trouble when they can go to the supermarket and pick up whatever they need.
Yep.
And that includes wine. And if the wine sucks, it's cheaper. And they don't care.
Yeah. You know, wine suckage is a matter of perception, right? Because the fact is that, you know, there are wines out there that are, you know, $10 or under that I might not care for, but you know, my mother loves, or, you know, my cousin loves, or what have you. So, you know, I'm very convinced that, you know, there's a place in the market for every kind of wine at every price point.
I agree.
Every audience, right?
Yeah, but I agree completely. I just wish that we could get people, once they try a wine that's super tasty because it's smooth and fruity, which means sweet, that we could get them to try something else. That's all I ask.
Well, and I think that that's, you know, I think that's a natural progression for most wine drinkers. And the fact is that there is no brand loyalty, very little brand loyalty in the wine business, right? I mean, there's some, you know, there's some people who are absolutely going to be, you know, Yellowtail drinkers, or, you know, absolutely going to be Behringer drinkers or what have you. But for the most part, people like the exploration that's involved with wine, right? Because they basically kind of says, you know, something new to try. I like that. Where's it from? They kind of take a little adventure through a glass. And so I don't think that's going to change at all. And in terms of like the influence of supermarkets as opposed to independent retailers, again, like, you know, in any industry, there's always, you know, you've got your top several players who dominate the market. You know, I mean, you know, in the wine business, you know, we know that like more than 50% of the wine is produced by like, you know, three or four companies. But the other, but there's a lot of room in that other 50%, right? And that, you know, there's a lot of small independents, and, you know, if you're able to carve out a niche, you can be very successful. You don't have to be a giant, you know, business in order to do that.
No, and that's a good point, because I know I've got a couple of producers, in fact, in California, that I like a lot. I think do a tremendous job, and one of them's 50,000 cases a year. And I've said, how do you, in California, how do you stay in business at 50,000 cases a year? And the land is paid for, so they, that's a, that helps. But my concern, Mike, is that given land prices, particularly in California, but I'm told this is happening elsewhere in the world, how are these niche people are going to be able to come in and make wine that's affordable? And you don't have to say my definition of affordable at
8. Right, so I was going to go there.
No, hey man, I'm ahead of you. Even allowing for affordable to be $15 or $20, which is still, you know, higher than the average bottle sold, how is there going to be room for these people in a business that is just so top heavy?
So really, this goes back to an early conversation we were having about how right now the younger generations, you know, millennials in particular and Gen Z, are really drinking less than their parents and their grandparents, but what they're doing is they're drinking better, right? So they may not be buying, you know, three bottles of $10 wine. They may be buying one bottle $30 wine instead, right? And that trend, I think, is going to continue. I think that people are, you know, that basically this, the especially the next generations, you know, I think there's a lot of misconception among certain marketers about how, like, those generations, they want like the kind of cool and trendy and hip, and, you know, to a certain extent that works for things like White Claw. But in addition, there's that, in that set, they want to enjoy the finer things. They prefer experiences over stuff. And what's a better experience than having a great bottle of wine with some friends at a restaurant or out on the porch or what have you? So the trend that I see there is that I think that some of the larger companies that are producing a lot of wine at a lower price point, they may struggle moving forward. And I think you're seeing some of them recognizing that fact, and they're going up market with several acquisitions of more premium brands. And, you know, they're starting to invest more in the kind of the upper part of the market. In terms of affordability that you just talked about, you know, affordable is subjective, right? You know, if you make $100,000 a year, your affordability is a lot higher than somebody who makes $20,000 a year, right? So
then a wine writer who specializes in $10 wine. you know what? You just said something really smart there that I hadn't thought about, Michael. The idea that about experience in wine, because you hear that a lot. And that's one of the phrases in wine I tune out because it's stupid, because most people don't just say it. They don't have any idea what it means. But what you just said, if you're going to go to all the trouble to buy a $30 bottle of wine or a $20 bottle of wine, you're going to have to get involved in, for lack of a better term, all the crapola about wine. Mm-hmm. And that means that you're going to have to know why that $30 bottle is $30 and why the other bottle's $8 or the other bottle's $15. Mm-hmm. And that, I think you're right. I've never thought about that until just this moment, the light bulb goes off. And I think you've come up with something there that really smart wine people are going to use to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's something that we do for our clients, and that is that basically, you know, we're giving them stories and giving them justifications behind those things, you know, showing why this is unique and why it's worth the value. We often use value, the word term value, in a pejorative way to basically say that, you know, if something's a value wine, you know, it's cheap.
Yeah, I've heard that once or twice.
It's a synonym for cheap. The fact is that
crappy value, and cheap.
Yeah. The fact is that value, when you take it in a more global context, you know, value is, you know, the how much you think something is worth, right? To you as a person, right? And so, you know, the value of something really depends on you and what you feel is going to be good.
So no, that's
providing value to customers is paramount to whatever we do, regardless of this wine or any other product. And we're seeing that all over the board in terms of consumer behavior.
Yeah. No, that's exactly. And I've argued that for years. Just because a wine is cheap doesn't mean it offers value.
Right.
And just because a wine costs $80 doesn't mean it doesn't offer value.
Right.
We had a wine last night for dinner, a Portuguese wine at $20. And I was stunned at how wonderful it was. And in fact, I'm gonna do something on the blog about it, because that illustrates exactly the point you're talking about. $20 is a lot of money to me to pay for wine. But if I enjoy it, then it's value.
Yeah. You just don't buy that other bottle of wine that you were gonna buy for this week, right?
Exactly.
Seriously. And you know, and then it comes down to, like, that's a great example of QPR. We use the term QPR, you know, quality to price ratio, right? So it really means, like, the value really is that quality to price ratio. If the quality to price ratio is high, then, you know, it's a good value. If it's low, then it's not. So it really kind of comes down to what a particular person values.
So is that like an 89-point wine costing $60?
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, 89 points that is given to $60 by one critic may be, you know, 95 by another. So it really goes to, you know, one thing that I think that few people recognize is the fact that a rating of a wine is a rating of that particular bottle from that particular vintage in that particular moment by one particular critic. Oh. Right?
Yes, I'm having my Fred Sanford moment.
So, and we all know that wine evolves and changes, you know, from one year to the next, from one month to the next, one year, week to the next, right? So really what they're doing is they're capturing that wine in that moment, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that wine isn't going to bloom and flower and become even better over the next several years. Right. So, like anything, ratings need to be taken in context. Right. So they're basically kind of a good gauge. Right. You know, when you, for instance, like when you go out to a restaurant, like for me and my wife, basically, you know, we're looking at, you know, ratings on Yelp or on TripAdvisor. Okay. So we say, okay, well, this one says this is 4 stars and this one says it's 4.5 stars. Is this 4.5 star better than that one? But then that leads to the questions of, okay, it's 4.5 stars, sure, but are they actually creating the cuisine that I want to eat, right? And that's the same thing with a wine critic. It's like, just because somebody rates something a 95 doesn't actually mean that that's a great wine for you, right? Because, you know, it may not be in a style that you necessarily like. So again, you know, like those ratings are definitely necessary to give people a certain amount of background, but then it's up to them to determine whether that aligns with their own values.
Their scores, as much as I hate them, I'll give them this, they're a place to start, but the only way to learn about wine is to drink it. And I just wish more people understood that too.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, people are looking for, so here's the thing to your point regarding earlier about like how the wine media has done an injustice to wine in general and wine criticism in general, is the fact that, and I think winers are also guilty of this, is making it a very exclusive product, making it a premium product that has to be controlled by certain Illuminati. You know, it's the old sommelier with the ashtray around his neck, right? So we've honestly, you know, up until recently, we've done a terrible job of being able to communicate about wine and make it fun, as you mentioned earlier. So, and I think that that's one of the reasons, actually, that's one of the reasons that the blogs emerged, and, you know, people were starting to write about wine on their own because, you know, they wanted to share their own thoughts about these things and give their own opinions, and people recognize that.
And I have nothing against the democratization of wine criticism, and I honestly thought that it would make wine more popular and allow a way for more people to enjoy wine. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work. And I think, as Alder Yarrow,
well, I don't know if it didn't work. I mean, I think there's, you know, I mean, you know, wine writing, wine criticism is very niche, right? You know, the percentage of the population who's going to be interested in reading a wine article is fairly small.
Very, very true.
You know, it's like the same kind of, you know, how many people want to read about a jig, you know, and woodworking, right? You know, it's even smaller than probably, well, maybe not than wine. So, you know, as long as people recognize the fact that it is a niche product and that you're talking to a smaller type of art audience, you can still be very successful in that environment, because you just have to, you know, recognize that and
when I say democratization didn't work, I think a couple of things happened why it didn't work. I think people went into it expecting to get a wider audience than they got, and to be able to make money off of it. And, you know, everybody always asks me, how do you start a wine blog? And I always say, make sure you have a real job first.
That's true.
And then eventually, you know, maybe you can wean off. And the other thing about it was, once these people saw what was happening, they got out of it. And,
well, yes and no. I mean, the real power of a wine blog to a blogger basically was it was a platform on which to launch their wine careers in one way or another, right? And, you know, perfectly acceptable.
It wasn't to let consumers know about great wine.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, no, because I mean, you start a blog because you want to start a blog, right? You know, it's something that interests you, and you want to just share it with whoever wants to read it. And then some had the intention of like using it as a platform to, you know, go on to bigger and better things. And some people are very successful doing that. Other people didn't have that interest, so they just kept writing, you know, whatever they did on their blog. Some people just kind of dropped it, whatever. But, you know, there's still new bloggers joining the discussion every day, you know. So I'm going to the Wine Media Conference in August this year, you know, which was once the Wine Bloggers Conference. You know, it's going to be interesting to me to see, especially after a year of COVID, to see like how many new faces are there and like how many new kind of nascent wine writers are in the room. I think that's actually kind of exciting.
You know, and it's interesting you mentioned that, and that goes exactly to our point. I've offered several times and had discussions with them and submitted proposals to do a seminar on how to make money being a wine blogger. And, you know, they always put these to a vote among the conference attendees. Yeah,
Nobody's interested.
Yeah, they weren't interested in the least. And I've always thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I know the organizers wanted me to do it.
Yeah.
But
No, well, it's interesting because, you know, it's Zephyr Adventures who organizes that conference. They also organize a food blogging conference. And it's really interesting to see the differences between wine bloggers and food bloggers, because wine bloggers, yeah, they don't really care about making money. They just, they're looking for an audience. They just, you know, they just want to enjoy it. They want to have a connection to the community, basically, and drink great wine with great people. Whereas in food blogging, you know, yes, it's very much the intention that they make money from their blogs through endorsements or through, you know, what have you, advertising, sponsorships, that sort of thing. And I think that's the case in a lot of different blogging areas and a lot of, like, you know, quote unquote influencers. You know, they're basically being paid to endorse particular products. Wine people are generally not interested in that.
And that's really an interesting approach to it. And that may explain why wine criticism is the way it is.
Yeah, and I think it still suffers from a bit of a old boys club sort of feel, like it's exclusive. You know, if you don't know the lingo, then you don't belong. You know, if you don't know, you know, exactly what the, you know, Premier Cru vineyards in and Burgundy are, then you're less than a, you know, expert.
You don't know which way the slope is and what the rocks are.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we all know that that's, you know, there are very few people in the world who actually know all that information. And, but you don't need to know that information to enjoy wine. So.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
What you do ask the guy you know who does, the person you know who does know it, if you ever have the question. And the rest of it is you just sit there and drink what you enjoy.
Yeah. So so anything else that we think, you know, in terms of future, what the future looks like for wine journalism and for that matter for public relations?
I think in all honesty, I think because so much of what I do, so many people, as Michael, as you just noted, do it and don't expect to make any money off it because they do have a day job. I think the much more interesting thing is going to be what happens on the marketing side.
Yeah.
And I think we saw a little bit of this with Rosé, with influencers and Instagram and stuff like that, which obviously was Rosé, so that was a little different. But I mean, are we going to start seeing this with Premier Cru Burgundy and First Growth Bordeaux and all of that stuff, where it will get away from all the old white guys and it will be people sitting there, you know, being Instagram influencers or TikTok influencers or whatever.
I hope so. We definitely need to see, have more disparate voices in the wine business. So it's something that we've talked about on this podcast previously, and I hope that we continue to have that conversation.
Although First Growth Bordeaux on TikTok to me would be a tremendous thing to see.
I might know somebody.
Let's do it, man. Let's set it up.
Yeah, why not? Okay. on that note, we'll wrap it up here. And I want to thank you, Jeff, for being on the show. It's been a great show. Great conversation. I think maybe we have to pick this up at some other time, talk a little bit more about it. So.
Thank you so much, Michael. No, it was great. I enjoyed it. And again, we need to do this much more often. It's always so good to talk to you because you're just so smart about wine. I don't talk to enough people anymore who are smart about wine.
Thankfully, I get to talk to a lot of people who are smart about wine. So that's definitely a perk of my job. So thanks again. And for my listeners, we will see you next week.
This has been Hit the Bottle, a production of Balzac Communications and Marketing. You can find past episodes on our website at htbpodcast.com. Drop us a line on social at htbpodcast or send us an email to mike@htbpodcast.com or emma@htbpodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen. If you like this show, please rate and review in any of the mentioned platforms. Thank you for joining us. Have a great day.